I'm going to turn it over now. This is kind of the keynote of the event here, where we get to hear from two of the main creators of Second Life, Phil Rosedale, the CEO of Linden Lab, and Corey Andreika, the CTO of Linden Lab. Can I ask, are you guys both coming out at once? Is Corey coming out first? Okay, come on guys, here. I'm just going to walk away from this.
Take over the whole world. In just a day, it's time for us. Okay. So, I really enjoy. I don't need these, my keys. I really enjoy having the opportunity to go last. It was so great to hear Mitch in particular this morning. I never heard Mitch really talk at length about Second Life. It's just incredible. You know, I've worked with Mitch. We've had something like 24 board meetings together. I have this strange habit of numbering them all in the slides, which apparently no one has ever seen a CEO do before. So, for some reason, we had these interviews. Yeah, so we've done a lot of time together, but I had never seen Mitch actually have to give the presentation, if you will. It had always been me, you know, doing that. And so that was just an amazing thing. And I think that Mitch said all the good stuff. So I was troubled by what to say, especially given the degree to which everybody knows what's going on with all this stuff. And most everybody here, who here has, that's an interesting question, who here has not heard me speak, like in world or a few people? Well, I guess maybe. So one of the points that Mitch made was about openness and about the future and how, where this is all going. It's clearly getting really big. I'm not going to waste any time on those numbers. I think the magic, the critical magic, if you will, of the community is already here with us today. You know, it feels to me at least like we've made it in the way that the real content development, the stuff you all are doing, is now happening. In a way that a couple of years ago, like Mitch said, put it so comically, you know, it was very much this tabula rasa in which we believed that people would come. But now it's happening. And so I think that given that, and given that it's easy in a sense to sort of see the future, one of the things Mitch said, this idea of openness made me think, we're in this odd state now where Second Life is still sort of this thing made by this one company, us, and rapidly evolving into this enormous set of demands and ideas and communities. And clearly, in the future, it's all going to be open, you know. It's increasingly going to be open, you know, systems and protocols and sources and all that. You know, for this thing to work and to become global in the way the internet became global, it's going to have to be much, much bigger than us. And it's going to have to get to a place where, really, you don't have to worry that much about what we, as a company, and Corey and I, as executives, have to say about what's happening. You kind of will be able to do it yourself and not listen to us at all. But for the time being, yeah, exactly. And that's how we handle things internally. but for now, you do, and it's sometimes an uncomfortable relationship, I know. You know, I'm one of the parties in it. You guys are the other side. You do have to have this situation where you have to rely on us to do the right thing. And I think so. So anyways, I was trying to think of stuff to talk about in my time with you, and I thought, given that Corey's got some really cool stuff that I can't really trump, so I thought what I would do is just tell you a little bit more about, tell you the story that I've told so many times, but actually, because it's often been told to like investors and people in the press who sometimes don't you know, write down all the whole thing, you probably haven't heard it. And that's just sort of like my background and how I came to all this and, you know, from my perspective, why it was interesting to do. So I thought that would kind of be fun, so we could start that. So in my house, where I grew up, when I was in junior high, I was struck by the desire to have my door in my bedroom go up, like on Star Trek. And so, I grew up in San Diego, and so I would be in the attic, and I got up in the attic, and I cut three of the roof joists. Not a really good idea. So, you know, the roof of my bedroom going out to the edge of the house kind of sagged a little bit. And I always wondered, being a pretty engineering-oriented little fellow, I always wondered what would happen and if someday the house could fall down. So I cut these roof joists and I put a garage door opener up in the attic. And I have this button, a pretty quiet one, and I had this button that I would hit, you know, the door would go up and down. And I hit this button. Super cool. Another time, when cable TV came in, my parents still had one of those old antennas that you used to turn around. Everybody remembers those, where you had the clicker thing that you could turn the antenna. So I liked the clicker thing. And I got up there on the roof and I took the old antenna down that wasn't being used anymore, and I put a big acoustic dish on the roof so that I could turn it around and I could listen to like what the other kids in the neighborhood were saying. They'd see this thing turning on the house and they'd know that I was in there. And then my third story about me as a kid, not that you need to hear anymore at this point, but I hope you understand. My third story was about the time that I wanted a car, like all people do, you know, when they're not 16. My best idea was, instead of getting a car, I could instead, out of the back of like Popular Science, I could get one of those hovercraft kits. And I'd build myself a hovercraft, a car-sized hovercraft, which I got about halfway through in the backyard. It sort of sat there and slowly rotting over the years, to my parents' displeasure. So this was me as a kid. I was a kid who was really into the way things worked. Just taking things apart and making stuff and doing electronics and building things and sawing up pieces of wood. And so I was just always dreaming up things to do, and for the most part, as you can imagine, not able to do them all that well. You know, the garage door thing was not such a clever idea, but in my mind, it was so cool. In my mind, when you came over to my house, I mean, hey, I had the door going up the sink. So, you see where I'm going with that, you know? I always wanted the world to be Lego, somehow. I just wanted to make things as a kid. So I think that's... I know that that's something that just stayed with me all the way. And so as I got older and I got better at these things, I was always just looking, particularly when computers really came around, I just wanted to use computers to build stuff. So that's an interesting story. I used to make my teachers stop and let me do like an impromptu show and tell of like the latest gadgetry I was working on. And like I said before, I was the kid who ordered those kits from the back of like Popular Mechanics. I was that kid. So that's one thing. I think another early influence that many people here could probably connect with was I learned to program computers more as tools. You know, I thought of a computer as just a hammer. I was never very elegant. I just wanted to do something cool with it. And I remember learning assembly language when I was in, I think in about junior high, because I had read this amazing paper in the back of Scientific American, and it was Stephen Wolfram, one of his papers on cellular automata. And it was very easy to implement one of these sort of scrolling up the screen, trees, you know, marvelous things in BASIC, but it was so slow that it wasn't very interesting. And so I remember saying, oh, all right then, I'm going to learn how to do assembly language programming today, and I'm going to write this thing in assembly language so it'll go fast. So what you've got, for those who haven't seen this, is, you know, with automata, is you get this wonderful thing that is evolving like the game of life, for those who have seen them, sort of flowing down the screen. Once written in assembly language, it did it pretty fast. And you could just imagine that there was this infinity of it beneath you. You know, you were watching all these mystical, you know, patterns flying by on the screen, and it only could lead me, at least, to just think and wonder, you know, wow, how deep does this go? How much stuff is in there? You know, how crazy is that? You know, I've written about this before. You know, that's outer space. You know, that's the place where anything could happen. It's just all on the computer. We can just program it to somehow make it. And so I was really, really also into that as a kid. So complexity, self-organizing systems, big out-of-control systems, I just thought those were fascinating because they seemed to be somehow the way that you would use computers to do whatever this next thing was going to be with them. And so that was another piece that I looked at. Now, as I got better with computers and started my little software company when I was in high school and did more and more programming, I was struck in the mid-90s by the idea that none of this virtual reality stuff, although it was amazingly well imagined, we were all dreaming about it, it wasn't possible. You couldn't actually do it. And a lot of people, a lot of companies were trying to do it. Mitch talked about a couple of them this morning. But there were really two things that kept this all from working. And there's lots of my friends who will tell you that I really did, even in the early 90s, I was just obsessed with all this stuff. But I said, you know what? It's not going to work. And the reason it wasn't going to work is because couldn't do Second Life is because there wasn't broadband. And 3D didn't really work on computers. Those are the two key things. And as it turns out, those two things got fixed in 1999. Broadband was kind of on its way to infinity. You knew everybody was going to use it. And NVIDIA released this card called the GeForce 2. And I got one of those. And I left in 1999, and about that time, knowing that this was happening, I left Real Networks. And I came back to San Francisco. I had been up in Seattle, and I started programming and playing around in this little office on Linden Alley here in Hayes Valley in San Francisco. Started programming with one of those graphics cards and using broadband to connect machines together, and just started playing around with the early ideas of Second Life. And the first thing that we simulated, the first thing we played around with just to show off those graphics cards and everything, was water. You know, simulated water, and you could make waves in it, and you could connect a couple of servers together that could simulate the water, and you'd leave at night, and you'd come in, and the water would still be kind of mysteriously in some new pattern. And I just remember thinking that was so cool. That idea of proceduralism and automata, it was a big, early, exciting element of Second Life. Corey was pointing out to me earlier that just the mystery of this sort of huge forest. We used to talk about this idea of a big evolving forest in which you could you had no idea what was there. It was so big that you'd just wander into it. People would pay just to walk in and kind of see what was in the forest. That idea was, I think, one of the formative ideas that drew some of the early engineers to Linden Lab. Was we were just all really kind of geeking out on this idea of what would happen if we could make this immensely complex procedural world. So there was something missing in our vision. It's really interesting to look back on. But I was so into this idea of, you know, SETI, you know, that program. All these machines could be connected together to do amazing stuff. So I'll tell you what was missing, the last piece of it, and the piece that really brought us to the modern era of Second Life, if you will. And that was, we had this board meeting. It was late in 2001. We had a lot working. We had some interesting bits and pieces of Second Life working in 2001. And we had a board meeting where we were sort of showing off the capabilities of Second Life. But at that time, we thought of the capabilities more as the structure by which all this stuff could sort of be made, you know, these forests and fighting and physics and all this stuff. And we thought of Second Life as more something that would be constructed and then experienced. And we were showing off at this board meeting all this crazy cool stuff with physics and different things. And when we got done with the demo and we wanted to go on to the, you know, how is the business doing and how much money is in the bank sort of piece of the board meeting, I said, we had a bunch of people, the rest of the engineers, there was like seven of us at the time, so Corey and I were in the meeting, and several of us were in the meeting, and then everybody else was in the other room, and we said to everybody else, hey, why don't you guys just goof off and make stuff, which really was not a part of the intent of the demo, the idea of making things. And so there was just a field down on the screen. It was a screen just up like this in the board meeting. It was just a field, and there was a bunch of these eyeballs, which is what our avatars used to be, just big eyeballs, moving around. And we just said, make stuff, and we're just going to talk, and you guys will be like background entertainment for us. And in retrospect, that was a really fortunate thing that I just accidentally said that, because what happened was we went on about the board meeting, and we were sort of watching in the background as everybody was doing stuff, and we realized that the city was emerging. That there was this just incredible thing that was emerging very, very fast beneath us. And we all started getting drawn more and more back to the screen. You know, like we were just, what's the numbers? It got so weird. And we'd start talking about it. And there was a snowman, I remember. A snowman showed up. So somebody built a snowman, and they put it on top. I'm looking at James. James says it was Andrew. So Andrew built a snowman. And I don't know if it was broken at the beginning, but then somebody else built, and you can see this happening, the snowman got built, and then somebody else built a sort of Burning Man, a bunch of small snowmen, like bowing down to the greater snowman. And so you could see this like jazz thing happening, right? You could see it happening in real time. And, you know, there'd never been a canvas in which two people could paint in that way at the same time, much less, you know, three or four or five, which is what we had. And so we were just transfixed by that. And that was this moment of change in that board meeting where we said, you know, it's not necessarily about the wind working really well, although I totally dug that. It's actually about people making things together. And what's going to come out of this is going to be like cities and places and intention and collaboration and community in some very strange new way, because the capabilities that this thing provides are almost, you know, I mean, they're mysterious in the degree to which they allow people to do things together. And so I think that was the point at which we kind of directed ourselves as energetically as we could toward building the capabilities, and I'd say it turned out to be a lot of work, more even now than we know, right, as we suffer with sometimes. We really turned to this idea of what we would have to do to let everybody get in and do this thing together. So I think that, that's the history that I remember. And then, you know, after that, it's all a blur, because, you know, it took off real slow, and then it kind of started accelerating, and then it started accelerating more, and then accelerated a lot more. And now I sort of am in that odd time. You know, I used to talk about how the event horizon of content creation, you've probably heard me talk about this before, you know, the rate at which people are building content in Second Life some time ago reached a point at which no one in this room could possibly in real time experience it. Isn't that an interesting thought? That you couldn't possibly see all the stuff that's being done. That's neat, because there was a critical point, I don't know exactly when it was, right, but it was a couple years ago or a year and a half ago, where that was crossed. And we'll never be, you know, gone back beyond again. So the content is now moving faster than all of us. And so for me, as a CEO of this, it's a very strange experience, because, you know, people come up to me all the time and they say, but did you, of course you've seen the la-di-da that's going on in the sim named whatever. And I don't even know the name of the sim, you know. I don't know whether it's an island or on the mainland. I don't know who's there. People come, you know, did you hear about this big new company that's doing this? And I didn't even know about it. So it's a fascinating experience to be part of a phenomenon like this. And in keeping with that, I'd say thanks to everybody here. Big thanks to Flipper and the SLCC group for bringing together what is, again, an emergent phenomenon. I was so delighted to see it happen last year, and I'm so much more delighted to see it happen, you know, at four times the size this year. Who knows what will happen next year, but thank you to everyone for bringing this all together. And with that, I will give the rest of the time here to Corey, and then we'll take some questions from everybody at the end, sit down and chat a little bit more. Thank you.